Okay, Psalm 45 was composed for the wedding of a king. And there's a couple of hints in the psalm. See, book two looks like most of it comes from the north, not from Jerusalem in its origins. They rarely use the word Yahweh. You've met it once there, but it's rare. They nearly always call God Adonai, which might be a hint. But there are two hints in this psalm that this is actually composed for the wedding of the great King Ahab and his wife Jezebel, the princess of Tyre. Now, who writes the history? The Bible in its final edition was written by the Jews, that is the people from Jerusalem. So you'd swear Ahab was an absolute terrible person. And his wife was up, yes. And they were, and I'm not saying they were saints, but actually from outside, if you look outside the Bible to the Assyrian, Babylonian world, the person they knew was not King David, the person they knew was Ahab. He was the great king of, you know, the Pharaoh type of figure. It's interesting to read from a different perspective. Whatever, there are little hints in this psalm that Ahab, it may have been his wedding to this beautiful princess from Tyre, which was the great Hong Kong of the time. For four centuries, Tyre dominated the whole of the eastern Mediterranean because all the trade came through Tyre. So it was a wealthy, and at high tide it was not connected to the land, so it was an island, it was pretty hard to get at and all that. In Christian reflection, we can apply this psalm to Christ the King and the Church his spouse. So you can read it at other levels. Apply it to your own marriage if it's going along nicely. Ready? Here's the psalm. My heart, says the psalmist, overflows with a noble theme. I dedicate my verses to a king. There might have been some money in it for him too, you know. Wedding of the king, and he's the poet laureate. So he's up there doing his bit for the cause and might get a vineyard out of it. Anyhow, he says, my heart overflows with a noble theme. I dedicate my verses to a king. My tongue is an agile pen of a scribe. And now, you are the most handsome of men. He'd like to hear that, wouldn't he? Grace is poured upon your lips, for God blesses you forever. That sounds good. Gird your sword upon your lips, for God blesses you forever. Gird your sword upon your thigh, O mighty one, in your splendor and majesty. Ride on victorious for the cause of truth and to defend justice. That's good. Let your right hand show your dread deeds. Your arrows are keen. Armies surrender to you. The king's enemies lose heart. Well, that's worth a few ducats. What am I doing? I know what I'm doing. Your throne, he says, is God's throne. It endures forever. Your royal scepter is a scepter of equity. Equity means, you know, equal judgment. That's quoted in Hebrews chapter 1, verses 8 to 9, and applied to Jesus. The throne that he's gone, the risen Christ, the King, the throne on the throne of heaven, etc. You love justice, you hate wickedness. Therefore God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness beyond your companions. And if you see in brackets, the word for love in Hebrew is Ahav. Ahav, the name of the king. Doesn't mean it was for his marriage, but you know, it's a little thing. And there's another hint coming later too that might persuade us. Your robes are fragrant with myrrh and aloes and cassia. I had to look all this up because I didn't have the foggiest idea what they are, and I've forgotten it now, so I have to write it down. But you might like to know that myrrh is a bitter aromatic resin that was traded from Arabia and Somalia. Aloes is from the resin and heartwood, the inner wood of a tree from India. trade, they travelled all right, don't worry about that. And cassia is from the bark of a tree in Sri Lanka. So that's all the trade that used to come up through the Red Sea and all that kind of thing, and into the, and then, right. So here they are, and he's got the lot, because he's king. From ivory palaces, stringed instruments celebrate you. Daughters of kings are among your ladies of honour. At your right hand stands the queen, queen mother, it is in the Hebrew, translated properly. It's his mother there, who's running the show, you might think. Adorned in gold of Ophir. Gold of Ophir, obviously famous gold. We still don't know where Ophir is. The scholars dispute it. Some say it's Arabia, some East Africa, and some it's India. I don't know, obviously, because no one else knows. But it was obviously the best gold you could get at the time. Now, the psalm talks to the bride, who's up there going, getting all, and they're pinning everything up and unpinning, and you know what it's all about. The unpinning is the more interesting. Anyhow, hear, O daughter, consider and listen. Forget your people and your father's house. The king is infatuated with your beauty. He is your lord. Bow to him. There we are. I hope the women here, when you're praying, this is part of the psalm you should take literally. Other parts you can allow a little bit of poetic license. Now, the next verse. The city of Tyre. Why is he talking about the city of Tyre? I don't know, but it might be. Jezebel comes from Tyre, so it's a likely, you know, that's all. The city of Tyre will seek your favours with gift, the riches of the people with all kinds of wealth. The princess is decked in her chamber with robes woven from gold. Remember your wedding day, girls? You had gold and gold. In many coloured robes she's led to the king, followed by her maiden companions, giggling all the way down the corridor. With joy and gladness they are led along as they enter the palace of the king. In the place of ancestors, you, O king, shall have sons. I hope you know why they wanted sons. I hope you know why people in some cultures of the world still see sons as special. It's traditional. It's actually erroneous, based on absolutely erroneous biology. But you've got to know that. And yet we keep it. Traditions are hard to change. The reason why sons are so important, and why when you read through the Old Testament, the genealogies, and they don't have women in them, is because women don't contribute to the life of the child. They never knew anything about the ovum. They even call the male contribution a seed, don't they? It's not a seed. A tree has seeds and drops a seed into the ground, and it grows in the ground because the tree produces the next seed, you get it? Drops into the ground, which nurtures it. They thought the male seed, which is fairly obvious, was the seed of human being. So the male contained the next generation in his loins, and he gave it to the woman, who then nurtured it beautifully. But she didn't hand on life, she nurtured it, do you get me? Now if you've got that understanding, then all your genes come through your sons. Your sons carry on your name, your sons carry on everything, they carry on your life. The women are there, the girls are there, becoming women, to nurture life, but not to produce it. You understand me? Now, if that's what your biology's like, that'll lead to a million little conclusions. What happens when your biology becomes corrected? People stay with the same old habits of thinking. But it's got to be revolutionised. I mean, women and men, neither of them have a seed, only together do they form life. Well, you know that. That changes everything. But there are still some cultures who want a son, and you have to ask why, and if you ask them why, they don't know, and if you tell them why, they don't believe you. Okay. In place of ancestors, you, O king, shall have sons. You will make them princes over the whole land. I will cause your name to be celebrated forever from one generation to the next, and the peoples will praise and thank you forever and ever.